The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And today we're reading from the edition dated June 17th, 2011. And we turn first to the main story section here. The first item is entitled, A Power Vacuum Opens in Yemen. What happened? Control of Yemen was up for grabs this past week after President Ali Abdullah Saleh was rushed to Saudi Arabia for medical treatment of serious wounds and burns suffered in a rocket attack on his palace. Saleh, 69, was burned on 40% of his body and face and had shrapnel wounds to his chest, according to Saudi officials, but is now stable. In an audio recording broadcast on state TV, the president blamed the attack on forces loyal to his main rival, tribal leader Sadiq al-Amar, who 2 weeks ago began battling government troops in the capital of Sana'a, after Saleh reneged on a deal to step down. The government said Vice President Abdu Rabu Mansour Hadi is the acting president until Saleh returns, while behind the scenes negotiations resumed for the ruling party to surrender power. The president's surprise exit was cheered by thousands of democracy protesters who have been camped out in Sana'a Central Square since February, demanding an end to his 33-year presidency. But while the Obama administration has been urging Saleh to step down, U.S. officials expressed fear that the terrorist group al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula would benefit if the government collapsed and Yemen became a failed state like Somalia. The al-Qaeda piece of it is incredibly dangerous and made that much more dangerous in the ongoing crisis, said Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on a visit to the region. AQAP, fronted by the American-born Islamist Anwar al-Awlaki, has been linked to several terror plots aimed at the U.S., including the Christmas Day 2009 underwear bombing attempt on a Detroit flight, and last year's plot to sneak explosives onto U.S.-bound cargo jets. Now here's what the editorial said. The Arab Spring has claimed another dictator, said the San Francisco Chronicle. Saleh tried every trick in the autocrat's playbook, from vaguely stated reforms to military attacks on protesters, to stay in office. But as in Tunisia and Egypt, mass street protests proved to be an irresistible force. Don't mistake Yemen for Tunisia or Egypt, said the Saudi Arabian Arab News. Yemen's revolution has degenerated into a free-for-all of competing militia tribes and powerful families and confederations. In the chaos, more than 200 al-Qaeda fighters took over the capital of the southern province of Abyan and declared it an Islamic emirate after they cleansed it of the agents of Americans. There's a real danger that al-Qaeda may use the power vacuum to its advantage, establishing regions of Yemen as a sanctuary for terrorists. Only a massive injection of aid could stop Yemen from becoming a failed state, said the London Independent. Saleh's regime crumbled because it ran out of money to buy the loyalty of key tribes. If the West lets Yemen disintegrate, the country will become a seething stew of disappointed ex-clients, Democrats, separatists, and Islamists. And now here's what the columns had to say. Yemenis are celebrating Saleh's departure, said Jeb Boone in Time. But should they be so happy? Loyalist troops under the command of Saleh's nephew, who are known for having itchy trigger fingers, still patrol the streets, pointing heavy Russian-made machine guns at anything that moves. Saleh's son and heir apparent, Ahmed, is still in the country, and the government insists Saleh is coming back soon. No one has any idea what happens next. The Saleh government's counterterrorism forces have already stopped their pursuit of ACAP, A-Q-A-P, said Peter Finn in the Washington Post. As a result, the U.S. might decide to act unilaterally. But don't be surprised to see a surge in U.S. drone attacks in Yemen in the coming weeks. If Saleh's government fails, Said Daniel Pipes in National Review, Yemen becomes a true al-Qaeda sanctuary, leading to yet more attacks being planned against Yemen for execution outside the country. There's a second nightmare scenario, total anarchy. Even before the recent anti-government uprising, impoverished Yemenis faced cataclysmic water and food shortages. If all order breaks down, it could prompt a mass, unprecedented, and tragic exodus out of Yemen, involving millions of people, a true humanitarian crisis. Our next item from the main stories this week, again from the war territories here, rethinking the timeline in Afghanistan. What happened? Well, the White House is considering an accelerated withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, prompted by the death of Osama bin Laden and the war's cost of more than $2 billion a week, according to reports this week. President Obama's national security team is advocating a rapid drawdown of the 30,000 surge troops that were ordered into the country in late 2009, paving the way for the removal of all 70,000 combat troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2012. Such a move would leave only 25,000 support troops in place to hand over power to Afghan forces by the previously agreed deadline of 2014. Many on both sides in Congress have been clamoring for a hastier retreat along those lines. Bin Laden is dead, said Representative Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina. Declare victory and come home. But that approach would put the president at odds with the Defense Department's calls for a more measured withdrawal. Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who retires this month, insists that combat troops should remain in Afghanistan until 2014 in the handover. I'd opt to keep the shooters and take the support out first, he said. Gates' position was strengthened this week by the release of a U.S. Senate report warning that U.S. efforts to build a stable government and effective security forces in Afghanistan might be undone by a rapid departure. Obama would only say that the coming months would be a summer of transition, but added, "We have now accomplished a lot of what we set out to accomplish 10 years ago." Now here's what the editorial said. You can see why Obama might be tempted to speed up the drawdown, said the Dallas Morning News. Voters don't like the war, Congress doesn't want to keep paying for it, and the man responsible for starting it is dead. But it would be foolish of the president to ignore the advice of Robert Gates, a reasonable, pragmatic defense secretary who understands the real-world effects of policy decisions. If Gates says, "We're not there yet," perhaps it's too soon to be backing out the door. But we can't afford to stay there any longer, said the Seattle Times. We have already spent $459.8 billion fighting the Afghanistan war, and that bill is rising by about $10 billion a month. This is a simply stunning sum to be spending trying to fix a broken country while we've got an economic crisis at home. And now here's what the columnist said. The situation on the ground favors a quicker exit, said Joe Klein in Time. U.S. troops have driven the enemy out of its natural heartland of Kandahar and Helmand provinces, making reconciliation talks with the Taliban more plausible. And while the Afghan National Army ain't the 101st Airborne, it should be strong enough by the end of 2012 to prevent the Taliban from retaking control of the country. The end to the war will begin in earnest by the close of this year. If we cut and run now, said Kimberly and Frederick Kagan in the Wall Street Journal, we risk losing all the progress we've made. The fight is approaching its peak, and we are on the verge of securing all of the country's southern cities for the first time since 2001. This is the time to press the fight, not quit. Pulling out now would also pose a grave risk for neighboring Pakistan, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. That country's civilian government is fragile, and its military is infiltrated by Islamists. Militants there would only be emboldened by a U.S. rush to the Afghan exits. We aren't going to win this war, said Henry Kissinger in the Washington Post. The surge has reached its limit of effectiveness, and our best alternative now is to negotiate with the Taliban. But if those talks are to succeed, we must keep up the military pressure. The more rapid and substantial the immediate withdrawal, the more difficult the negotiating process will be. In the meantime, Obama must persuade other countries in the region that the outcome in Afghanistan is an international political problem, not an American one. Every neighbor would be threatened, including China and Russia, if militant Islam isn't checked in Afghanistan. And now, from the Week magazine this week, let's turn to the controversy of the week. Obama, will the economy sink his re-election? Osama bin who? Said Zachary Goldfarb in the Washington Post. Only a month ago, there was speculation that by killing Osama bin Laden, Barack Obama had just guaranteed himself a second term in office. But last week, a series of grim economic reports put an end to any notion that President Obama's re-election campaign was gaining momentum. More than a year into a supposed recovery, house prices continue to be in free fall nationwide. The monthly employment report showed the recovery stalling, with a measly 54,000 jobs added in May, and the unemployment rate edging back up to 9.1%. Time is running out for the White House, said Andrew Leonard in Salon.com. No president has been reelected with unemployment above 8% since FDR, and if the public perceives the economy as stuck in the doldrums, or worse yet, sliding back into a second recession, Obama could easily suffer the fate of Jimmy Carter in 1980 or George H.W. Bush in 1992. Obama's defenders say he inherited the economic crisis from President Bush, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal, and they're right. Obama took office amid a financial crisis, with the nation weighed down by ballooning debts and deficits, and at a time of unprecedented political dysfunction in Washington. These things weren't his fault, but through his decisions, he made them all worse. His emotional distance and ill-concealed contempt for Republicans undermined any attempts at negotiation and compromise, and the $800 billion he threw at a stimulus program failed to jumpstart the economy while deepening the deficit. It's little wonder that only 41% of voters approve of his economic stewardship, and that his overall job approval rating has slid back down to 47%. The 2012 Republican campaign will consist of four devastating words. He made it worse. That's really beyond dispute, said Fred Barnes in the Weekly Standard. As a big government liberal, Obama knows nothing about what stirs the economy and produces jobs and growth. If Republicans keep reminding voters of that fact, they'll oust him and win big in 2012. To beat him, Republicans need a credible candidate, said Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. Polls show a surprising reservoir of good feeling toward Obama. A majority of voters like him personally and consider him a strong leader, which is why his job approval numbers remain decent in the face of dreary economic news. Barring a double-dip recession, he's still likely to win, thanks to the GOP's field of substantially flawed candidates. From the wooden, flip-flopping Mitt Romney to Tea Party favorites Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain, who would terrify independents. Ronald Reagan, remember, won re-election in 1984 with unemployment at 7.4% because he convinced voters that the worst was over and prosperity was about to return. Yes, but counting on the public's patience and forbearance isn't a winning strategy, said Dan Balls in the Washington Post. Voters are feeling real pain and uncertainty, and even if they don't explicitly blame Obama for the loss of their homes or their jobs, they want something done about it. As elections draw near, said statistician Nate Silver in the NewYorkTimes.com, voters' views of their own fortunes and the president's performance become one and the same. If in the fall of 2012 the economy still looks bleak, Republicans will torture Obama with the question Reagan asked voters just before he upset Carter. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And now we'll turn to the popular column every week in the Week magazine, Good Week For and Bad Week For. It was a good week for obvious explanations. after a Frontier Airlines employee called a hazmat team to examine a mysterious white powder found on a diaper-changing counter in an airplane bathroom. The substance turned out to be baby powder. Starting early, it was a bad week, or excuse me, it was a good week for starting early after Matt and Ellie Green of White House, Texas made a Facebook profile for their daughter, Mariah, even though she's yet to be born. Mariah, who already has 268 friends, spends most of her time swimming, the profile said. And it was a good week for living in a dictatorship after a North Korean happiness study concluded that North Korea was the second happiest country in the world behind China. Cuba was the third happiest, while the U.S. was ranked last at 203. And that survey was done in North Korea. It was a bad week for Fox News after the network mistakenly showed Tina Fey imitating Sarah Palin instead of Palin herself in a report on whether Palin will run for president. Fox said a producer had been disciplined and that any repeat of the error would lead to dismissals. It was a bad week for Germany after a poll of 30,000 people by social networking site Badu.com named Germans the least funny nationality. Russians and Turks were also deemed not very amusing. And it was a bad week for Tempting Fate after the Titanic II, a 16-foot cabin cruiser owned by Mark Wilkinson of Birmingham, England, sank on its maiden voyage when a hole opened up in its hull. "It's all a bit embarrassing," said Wilkinson, "and I got pretty fed up with people asking me if I had hit an iceberg." And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's turn now to the People's section. Our first item is Taking Sinatra His Way. Barbara Sinatra never had any illusions about the man she married, said Andrew Goldman in the New York Times Magazine. The former showgirl became Frank Sinatra's fourth wife after meeting him at a party. During a game of charades, she called time on Sinatra, and he responded by grabbing the clock and smashing it against the wall. "He came from Hoboken, where the streets were very tough," Barbara says. "I guess some of that came back when he was drinking." Other people might have taken the boozing and the outbursts as a warning to stay away, but Barbara found Sinatra irresistible. "He had the most vibrant, electric, deep blue eyes in the world. He had a sexual energy all his own. Even Elvis Presley, whom I met in Vegas, never had it quite like that." Despite his moodiness, Sinatra showered her with diamonds, gifts, and affection. "He was always very much a gentleman, and he really cared about treating me well," she said. To keep the peace, she turned a blind eye to his carousing, believing it was immaterial to their marriage. "I tried not to meddle in his personal business." She felt like the luckiest woman in the world to be his wife for 22 years until he died in her arms at 82. "Once he turned on the charm," she says, "all my defenses rolled away like tumbleweed." The next item, the hot-headed yogi. For a yogi, Bikram Choudhury is surprisingly belligerent, says Damian Whitworth in the London Times. The inventor of the eponymous Bikram form of yoga, a rapid series of poses in a room heated to 105 degrees, studied yoga in India from the age of 4, moved to America, started doing training courses, and became a rich man. "Now 100 million people do Bikram yoga on this earth today," he says. He also claims to have healed a blood clot in President Nixon's leg and to have taught Pope Paul VI about yoga. What he hasn't yet mastered is the art of talking to journalists. "I don't like to talk the negative things," he grumbles. "People get cancer and people die in chronic disease. You know who is responsible for that. The media. I can keep you alive for 100 years. That's why Pope come to me. Whole world come to me. You came here with a negative attitude. He recalls another journalist who offended him. I said, you know what? I don't think a fat bitch can write a good story about me. So come to my class, lose 60 pounds, then I'll give you an interview. She thinks because she's a reporter that I'm going to, well, I'll just say defer to her rather than use the actual words here, but she don't know Bikram Choudhury. Mrs. Gandhi also scared of me, he said. And the next item today is Pitt's life as a dad. Brad Pitt has evolved from sexiest man alive to world's greatest dad, said Kenneth Miller in USA Weekend. At 47, he leads a highly unusual family life, raising six kids aged 2 to 9 with Angelina Jolie. It's an experience that's won him some hard-earned maturity. Kids hold up a mirror to you, he says. You can't make excuses. The family splits time between movie sets and homes in Los Angeles and southern France. We're pretty nomadic, he says. We go where the crops are. As glamorous as it all seems, Pitt admits that fears for his kids' safety sometimes keep him up at night. We're hunted. Our kids have to live behind a gate. Outside, there are people with cameras, but I'll take the trade-off. I never knew I was capable of such love. At home, Pitt says, Angie and I do everything we can to carve out some semblance of normalcy for them, to recreate the kinds of moments that were special for us. We have mud fights. It's chaos from morning until the lights go out. And sometimes after that, his family life, he concedes, is a bit extreme. But I like extremes. I guess I have always operated that way. Now let's turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine for this week, and this week's section is entitled Pain at the Pump. Gas prices are close to their record high. Whose fault is it? And is $3 a gallon gas gone for good? Has gas ever cost this much? Yes, once before, in July 2008, when the national average price of a gallon peaked at $4.11. The national average recently surpassed $4, and in some regions, prices climbed past $4.50. Prices have come down, but are still much higher than January's average of $3.07. The recent spike in prices has prompted a new rush on high-mileage cars and urgent calls for Washington to do something, from opening up the Alaskan wilderness for drilling to releasing some of the 727 million barrels of oil in the nation's strategic petroleum reserve, to imposing an excess profits tax on the oil companies. Do oil companies control gas prices? No one controls gas prices, not the president, not Saudi Arabia, not even ExxonMobil, the world's largest producer. About two-thirds of pump prices reflect the notoriously volatile price of crude oil, which has been driven up by two principal factors: increasing demand from the developing economies of China and India, where millions of people are buying cars, and the uncertainty about supply caused by the political unrest of the Middle East's Arab Spring. Higher demand and uncertain supply are likely to be permanent. The age of cheap oil is over, says International Energy Agency economist Faith Birrell. In addition to these long-term trends, gas prices often rise in the spring for other reasons. More expensive additives are required during warmer months, and many refineries shut down temporarily at this time of year to repair and upgrade equipment. Do the oil companies prosper when prices climb? Yes, lavishly. The six largest global producers raked in $38 billion in profits for the first quarter of 2011. ExxonMobil's quarterly profits were 69% higher than they were a year earlier. That's mainly because extraction costs, while rising, are far less volatile than oil prices. They currently stand at an average of about $10 a barrel, or less than a tenth of of the world oil price. Big Oil's high profits moved Senator Jay Rockefeller, the great-grandson of Standard Oil founder John D. Rockefeller, to call current oil executives deeply and profoundly committed to sharing nothing. The Obama administration wants to end tax breaks worth $22.8 billion to the oil companies through 2016, but last month, congressional Republicans roundly defeated a bill targeting a fraction of that. In the end, there's no simple mechanism for curtailing the profits companies reap in a complex world market. Why do the prices vary so much? Partly because of state taxes, which range from a low of 8 cents per gallon in Alaska to a high of 51.9 cents in Connecticut. In California, prices are also raised by the state's stringent anti-pollution laws, which require that the gasoline sold there contain emissions-reducing additives. And although your local filling station might bear the logo of Exxon or Shell, it's probably owned and operated by an independent business person who purchases gasoline from a wholesaler that may not be affiliated with the name on the sign. Wholesalers charge different customers different prices, depending on traffic density, the surrounding area's average income, and the number of competing gas stations nearby, among other things. Where does that leave consumers? Shopping around and driving less. Roberta Brown of Apache Junction, Arizona, hates it when she gets stuck having to fill up in nearby upscale Scottsdale, where she says gas prices are 20 cents a gallon higher. Paying that much scares me, she says. We're right on the edge of our budget. Longer term, the surest way to cut costs is to drive fuel-efficient vehicles or simply to drive fewer miles. But economists say consumers rarely change their gas consumption habits until rising prices become psychologically painful. $4 a gallon is the generally agreed tipping point. Below that level, consumers compensate for rising fuel costs by skimping on restaurant meals, clothing, or even health care. So what can the government do? Well, not much. Some politicians want to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling, but it would be more than 5 years before any oil could be pumped there, and its price would be subject to the same factors that are driving oil prices up in general. The government has raised some eyebrows by requesting a release of 5 million barrels from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but only in order to repair a storage cavern. A larger release might briefly push prices down by a few pennies per gallon, but they would bounce back up when the government purchased oil to refill the reserve. An ongoing federal investigation into oil price manipulation might nab some cheaters, but ultimately the oil market is simply too big and too complex for even the most determined criminal to wrangle. Americans don't want to hear it, but President Obama was right when he said there's no silver bullet that can bring down gas prices right away. And the footnote to today's briefing entitled Pain at the Pump is How to Rig the Price of Oil. Can oil prices be fixed? Federal regulators last month filed a civil suit against two oil traders and the firms they work for, accusing them of trying to do just that. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission alleges that in January 2008, traders Nicholas Wildgoose and James Dyer bought up control of two-thirds of the physical supply of West Texas Intermediate in order to create the appearance of a supply shortage and drive prices up. At the same time, the suit claims the two men bought futures contracts for an equivalent amount of oil that would pay off big if the price fell. That's precisely what happened when they dumped all their oil into the market, generating a $50 million profit for their firms. Parnon Energy and Arcadia Petroleum, which are owned by Norwegian billionaire John Fredriksen. The firms and traders have denied wrongdoing. They stand to pay up to $150 million if the feds prevail in court. Now let's turn to the best columns in the U.S. this week, according to The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Medicare, as we know it, is doomed. And this was written by Robert J. Samuelson in the Washington Post. Ending Medicare as we know it by using that stock phrase to terrify retirees, said Robert J. Samuelson, Democrats are attacking Republican Representative Paul Ryan's plan to transform Medicare. But the reality is that the cost of the current Medicare system, $520 billion last year, is soaring out of control. If it is left alone, it will eat up over 30% of the federal budget by 2016. In short, unless we end Medicare as we know it, America as we know it will end. Ryan's proposal would provide each Medicare recipient with a fixed amount of money to buy private insurance. Doctors would be rewarded for providing more efficient care to seniors instead of just running up the bill. President Obama, on the other hand, prefers to cut costs by putting more decision-making in the hands of government bureaucracies. Which is realistic and which is wishful thinking? The country deserves a substantial, reasoned debate on that question, not political scare tactics. One way or another, Medicare, as we know it, is going to end. The next column is entitled, Women Jailed for Getting Abortions, and it was written by Michelle Goldberg in thedailybeast.com. The back alley abortion is coming back, said Michelle Goldberg, as state legislatures have imposed more and more restrictions on abortion. Desperate women are taking matters into their own hands and being charged with crimes. A 32-year-old Idaho mother of three was arrested last week for inducing an abortion with drugs obtained over the Internet. She said she couldn't afford a legal procedure and now faces a felony conviction and 5 years in jail. In South Carolina, a Mexican migrant with three children served 3 months in jail for inducing her own abortion with pills. And in Iowa, a pregnant 22-year-old was charged with attempted feticide on the suspicion that she threw herself down a flight of stairs to end her pregnancy. These cases are harbingers of what's to come. Just this year, states passed 64 new anti-abortion laws and introduced 900 new restrictions. The collateral cruelty of these laws demonstrates that despite their denials, right-to-lifers have few qualms about turning women who have abortions into criminals. In liberal enclaves, the idea of women being jailed for such desperate acts may seem inconceivable, but in fact, it's a slowly encroaching reality. And our next column is entitled, How Colleges Are Failing Students, written by Richard Arum and Josepha Roxa in the Los Angeles Times. As this year's graduates leave school with diplomas costing up to $200,000, said sociologist Richard Arum and Josepha Roxa, they may be asking themselves, was college worth it? In many cases, the answer may be no. We recently conducted a study of thousands of college students as they moved through 4 years of school and found that some were so poorly prepared for the future that they graduated with little more than a paper diploma and an expanded roster of Facebook friends. In a typical semester, half of the students didn't take a single course that required more than 20 pages of writing, and less than a third had a class for which they even read 40 pages a week. Students who studied less than 5 hours a week, nonetheless, had an average GPA of 3.16. It's easy to blame the students, but the fault really lies with the university system, now focused on increasing revenue by offering soft courses, inflated grades, and deluxe dorm rooms. All that makes for a fun 4 years of hanging out, but it doesn't nurture critical thinking, complex reasoning, or writing skills necessary to be successful in today's knowledge-based economy. And now we'll flip through to the back of the magazine, the Week magazine for this week. The Last Word. This week it's entitled, Evel Knievel's Last Jump. The daredevil badly needed a comeback, says Lee Monville, so he tried a stunt that was doomed to fail. Evel Knievel arrived in London on May 6, 1975, which gave him almost 3 weeks to promote his next big jump at Wembley Stadium. After the Snake River disaster, this would be his triumphant return, and there was no need to hold back. Knievel might have been unknown in Great Britain, but he was made for the British tabloid press. He spoke only in headlines, dressed only in his flamboyant outfits, carried his cane full of whiskey, drove around in the candy apple red customized Cadillac pickup truck. Frank Gifford, the former New York Giants running back, famous now as Monday Night Football's play-by-play man, was the Wide World of Sports broadcaster for The Jump. He had become friends with Knievel, spent some time with him beyond the normal ABC meetings. He liked Knievel, liked his style. He was a little wacko, Gifford said. I kind of admired him. The night before The Jump, Knievel asked the 44-year-old Gifford to have dinner with him. They went to a restaurant where Knievel, surrounded by Brits, told his stories, drank straight from the cane, drank an assortment of other drinks that arrived at the table. Dinner was followed by visits to a string of pubs and more drinks. The next day he was a mess. Gifford was with him when he went out to Wembley Stadium and took his first look at the ramp and the 13 buses he would attempt to jump on his motorcycle. "I can't do this," he said. Gifford's reaction was, "What do you mean you can't do this? If you can't do it, then don't even try. Pull the plug right now." "I can't do that," Knievel said. "Take a couple of buses out of the line, easy." "I can't do that," Knievel said. He said that there was not enough room on the takeoff ramp to get up to speed, not enough speed to clear the buses. He said that was too bad, but he still would do the jump. Gifford wanted nothing to do with a stunt that was this risky. He didn't want to be part of a televised death. Panicked, he searched for Doug Wilson, the producer. He explained his worries. Wilson became worried, too. They went back to see Knievel at his trailer. They knocked on the door, no answer. Knocked on the door again, no answer. Opened the door, Knievel was asleep. Gifford woke him up. Asked how he felt now. Knievel said he was fine. He would find the speed somewhere. The show would take place. Gifford still wasn't sure about any of this, still was nervous, but at the appointed time, 4:20 on a Monday afternoon in London, he was in his yellow ABC blazer. Knievel was in a new set of leathers, blue just for Wembley, with enormous white French cuffs. He was doing some wheelies, then his two warm-up trips down the ski slope, stop, down the ski slope, stop. I was talking with him today, and he looked out at the 70,000 people here and said, "What does a man have to do to get this many people together?" Gifford said on television. I said, "Evil, you're doing it." This was the largest live crowd that ever had seen him perform, the largest by far. This was the crowd that should have been at Snake River, kids and families. The prices ran from $3 to $8 for the show. Affordable. This was his public relations masterpiece. He came down the ramp on that third trip, after he gave a thumbs up to let the producers know this was for real, tried to get the speed up to somewhere between 93 and 95 miles per hour, the number he felt would give him a distance of 130 feet, enough to clear the buses. The parabola was all wrong from the beginning, too flat, too short. He came down hard on the front wheel of the plywood safety extension that covered the top of the last two buses. Blam! The 13th bus. The motorcycle bounced high in the air. He was thrown forward. There was a moment perhaps when he could have saved himself. He tried to hang on, but then he was gone. Over the handlebars, flipped, flying, gone. He landed and rolled over and rolled again, and the motorcycle followed him, stalked him, seemed to know what it was doing. When he stopped rolling, the motorcycle rolled on top of him. "He's down and he is hurt," Gifford said on the telecast. "Oh, my God," Knievel's mechanic John Hood was the first one to Knievel. He pulled the motorcycle off Knievel's legs. Frank Gifford was close behind. Gifford was terrified. He saw a bone sticking out of Knievel's hand. He saw blood coming from his mouth. Gifford thought he not only had been a part of a televised death, he was part of a televised death of a friend. The crash was violent and stunning. How could anyone survive? Knievel had almost landed at Gifford's feet when he finally stopped. The announcer dropped his microphone and bent down and was only slightly heartened by the fact that Knievel was trying to speak. This would be the daredevil's dying declaration, possibly his last words. Gifford listened very hard because he wanted to make sure he heard exactly what Knievel said. "Frank," Knievel said. "Yes, Evil," Gifford said. "Get that broad out of my room," Knievel said. The scene that followed was dramatic, melodramatic, serious, yet strange, part B-movie, part Omorongo passion play, part Roadrunner cartoon. Knievel was shifted carefully to a stretcher, carried toward an ambulance. The crowd was beginning to cheer. He was alive. Knievel didn't want to go to the ambulance. He wanted to go to the ramp, wanted to talk to the people. He wanted a microphone. Forget the blood, the bone in his hand. The route was turned toward the ramp. Room was cleared with each step. The microphone was brought close. Knievel asked to be helped up. The process was very slow. When he finally stood, one arm over the shoulder of promoter John Daly for balance and strength, he made his announcement. "Ladies and gentlemen of this wonderful country," he said into the microphone, "I have to tell you that you are the last people in the world who will see me jump, because I will never, ever, ever jump again. I'm through." The reaction from the English crowd was mixed. There were as many boos as there were cheers. A lot of people who thought this was an act, he really wasn't hurt, couldn't be hurt. He was up there talking. The people around him knew differently. He clearly was injured. He was in a lot of pain, winced every time he moved. His hair was everywhere, his face as dirty as if he had come from 8 hours in the mines back home in Butte, Montana. He should have been somewhere in the middle of the city now, siren blaring, heading toward an emergency room. But he was here. He wanted to walk off the ramp. "Walk off the ramp?" Gifford said. He should get on the stretcher. "Help me walk off the ramp," Knievel said. "I got you, buddy," Gifford said. He walked off the ramp. Progress was very slow. Gifford at one side, John Hood at the other side, but he walked. Every time he paused, someone would suggest the stretcher. Every time someone suggested the stretcher, Knievel would plead his case. "I want to walk out. Please help me out. I want to walk out. Please." "I want to tell you something, Frank. I don't know how I got here. I'm hurt awful bad. I walked in, and I want to walk out." He eventually was put on the stretcher, lifted into the ambulance, taken to the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel, a two-hour trip through traffic. He was diagnosed with a broken right hand, a compressed fracture of the fourth and fifth vertebrae in the lower part of his spine, a fractured left pelvis, and a 7 3/4-inch split in his right pelvis. Once again, his injuries, as serious as they were, did not match the impact of the pictures of the crash. The dialogue, the words to the crowd, the way he looked. This again was stuff that never had been seen on television. This was more than reality. This was hyper-reality. He looked as if he were dead. In the hospital, Knievel blamed his idiot mechanic and the buses. And the American bus was 8 feet wide. The London bus was 8.5 feet wide, 6 inches per bus, 13 buses, a 6.5-foot difference. Give him the extra 6.5 feet and he would have made the jump perfectly. Give him different gears based on the knowledge that the buses were wider, and he would have made the jump perfectly. The idiot mechanic kept quiet because he was in need of a job, but pointed out a couple of things years later. The first was that Knievel had practiced only once, and that was that time for the press in the parking lot. The second thing was that this was the first time in his life that Knievel ever talked about technical things. He was not a technical man. He basically used two Harley XR750 bikes for his shows, one bike for wheelies and the other one for jumps. The wheelie bike was geared lower, so it was easier for him to flip the front end upward and ride that way. The jumping bike was set up with higher gears for the speed necessary to make the jump. The miss was no different from any of Knievel's misses. It was a miscalculation. He had no speedometer on the bike, no tachometer, did no research, nothing. He jumped totally on instinct and feel. His feeling was wrong here. The retirement lasted 3 days. The Wide World Show wouldn't be seen until Saturday, and on Thursday at 5:30 in the morning, Doug Wilson's phone rang in New York. Wilson had returned home to edit. Knievel told him to make a big edit, Wilson should cut out that whole speech to the crowd. Turned out Knievel didn't mean it. He wasn't going to retire. The speech would look stupid. No, it won't, Wilson said. We'll say something. People will understand. You can't run it, Knievel said. We're going to run it, Wilson said. Knievel became angry. He threatened to sue Wilson, to sue ABC, to sue everybody concerned if the speech ran. On Saturday, the show ran, the retirement speech ran. The tape was spellbinding. This was something that people did not see in the technology of 1975. This was different. This was exciting. Argue the morality of what this guy did for a living, fine, but admit that this was some kind of show. He walked in and he was going to walk out. After the flop at Snake River Canyon, this was the rebound of Evil Knievel. He was in the hospital for 11 days, then back at the Tower Hotel for five more. His wife Linda hurried to London along with his kids Kelly and Robbie. They accompanied him back to New York and then home to Butte, where he was scheduled for three more weeks of bed rest. He said he would return to London in the fall to tackle those buses again. You told 70,000 people you were going to retire, said a reporter at John F. Kennedy Airport. How can you say now that you're going back? I don't care what I say, Knievel said from the gurney. The schedule calls for me to jump again in September. And that was excerpted from the recent article published Evil by Lee Montville, and it was reprinted with permission from Doubleday, a division of Random House. Now back to more news in the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. This first article is entitled Wiener National Laughingstock. Erections have consequences, said the New York Post in an editorial. Representative Anthony Wiener of Brooklyn learned that the hard way this week when he admitted after days of heated denials that he'd sent lewd photos and messages to at least a half dozen young women, including the image that made him a national laughingstock, a cell phone shot he took of his boxer shorts displaying his excitement. In a long, tearful, and excruciating press conference, the famously belligerent Liberal Democrat apologized profusely to his constituents and his wife of 1 year, but insisted his sexting did not reflect on my official duties, and he refused to resign. Sorry, but a dozen sniveling apologies are not good enough, said the New York Daily News. Wiener, it turns out, repeatedly, even obsessively, engaged in phone sex and other lurid activities while he was in his congressional office, supposedly working in behalf of his constituents. Congressman Creep needs to go. How is this any of our business? Said Connor Friedsdorf in the Atlantic.com. The only real victim here is Wiener's wife, Huma Abedin, who is an unfortunate coincidence, was Hillary Clinton's top aide during the Lewinsky affair. But as the Clinton scandal proved so graphically, it's both prurient and pointless to obsess over the sexual behavior of egocentric alpha males who populate the political world. There is no evidence whatsoever that a politician's sex life reflects on his fitness for office. Besides, said Ronnie Polanski in the Philadelphia Daily News, Wiener wasn't one of those sanctimonious Pauls who build their careers preaching family values and the sanctity of marriage. Wiener may be a schmuck and a cad, but at least he's not a hypocrite. If Wiener hangs tough, said Steve Kornacki in the Salon.com, he can probably keep his congressional seat. The question is whether he'll really want to. Until this week, there were two main reasons Wiener served as a congressman: to set up a run for mayor of New York in 2013, and to further his career as a wisecracking, Republican-bashing cable news all-star. Wienergate has emphatically ended all of that. If he stays in Congress, it will be as a chastened, low-profile backbencher. He'd find that excruciatingly boring. There's a cruel, delicious irony here, said Daniel Flynn in HumanEvents.com. Wiener owed his career to the camera, but it was a camera in the end that did him in. Live by the sword and die by the sword. In a somewhat related article, I suppose, the next item is John Edwards. Did he break the law? John Edwards is guilty, said the Denver Post in an editorial. Guilty of cheating on his wife while she was dying of cancer. Guilty of fathering a child out of wedlock. And guilty of lying about it when he got caught. By all accounts, his sleazy behavior ended his career in politics. But now the question is, by acting like such a creep, did he break any laws? Last week, federal prosecutors charged Edwards with violating campaign finance laws by spending $925,000 donated by two wealthy supporters to hide Mistress Riel Hunter and their baby during his presidential run. If Edwards is convicted, he will lose his law license and spend time in jail. Edwards is a cad, to put it mildly, said the Washington Post, but it's troubling that the Justice Department chose to devote its scarce resources to pursuing this questionable case. His political career is over. His reputation is ruined. What's the point of prosecuting him on a very loose interpretation of campaign finance law? Shed no tears for John Edwards, said Mona Charon in TheNationalReview.com. In his brief, meteoric political career, he posed as a champion of the little guy. Liberals swooned. In reality, Edwards was a fortune-hunting, slick, and unscrupulous trial lawyer who specialized in falsely convincing juries that it was obstetricians' fault that babies were born with cerebral palsy. Now the man who made millions from sweet-talking juries will have to work his magic on one more jury, said the Washington Times. Good luck, Johnny boy. You'll need it. Actually, he's got a good chance of beating this rap, said Richard Hasen in Slate.com. Campaign finance law specifically says it's illegal to pay a candidate's personal expenses if these payments would have been made irrespective of the candidacy. Edwards contends he used the money to keep Hunter and the baby out of sight in order to save his marriage. The government says he did it to run for office. The distinction there is so murky and vague that it will be hard to prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Nonetheless, Edwards' lawyers are hoping to get the charges dismissed before the case goes to trial, said Bradford Plumer in TheNewRepublic.com. They know that if the fate of this universally loathed phony is put in a jury's hands, Edwards really might be screwed. Our next item, cyber attacks. Acts of war? Hackers of the world beware, said Siobhan Gorman and Julian Barnes in the Wall Street Journal. The Pentagon is fed up and is not going to take it anymore. Alarmed by the increasingly sophisticated hacking of the computer systems of American companies and the U.S. government itself, the Pentagon is creating a new national strategy that would classify serious cyber attacks as acts of war, meriting a traditional military retaliation. If you shut down our power grid, said one military official, maybe we will put a missile down one of your smokestacks. In an era when nearly everything is controlled by computers, this new policy is long overdue, said the Kansas City Star in an editorial. Russia is widely thought to have breached U.S. military computer systems in 2008, while Chinese hackers penetrated Google's servers last year. Lockheed Martin, one of our largest military contractors, recently admitted its computer system had been infiltrated by an unknown hacker. The threat that cyber warfare poses is enormous, said Con Coughlin in the London Telegraph. Hostile regimes such as China and Russia now employ hundreds of sophisticated hackers to probe the West's computer systems. It's possible that enemy nations or terrorists could shut down power grids, plunging entire regions into darkness, or create havoc with water and natural gas supplies, or shut down banks and stock markets. In fact, one intelligence source told me the consequences of a cyber attack could be more devastating than an Al-Qaeda dirty nuclear bomb. But a threat to bomb hackers may not be the answer, said David E. Hoffman in Foreign Policy. In cyber conflict, it's not often possible to know who the attackers are, as they cover their tracks by rerouting through servers around the world. Often they are employed by governments, not by governments, but by smaller players and non-state actors. And while talk of putting a missile down someone's smokestack is gratifyingly macho, says James Temple in the San Francisco Chronicle, China and Russia simply won't believe the U.S. would kick off World War III over a data breach. A wiser option might simply be a cyber response in kind. The next time we suspect a foreign nation of sponsoring a cyber attack, the U.S. should launch a counter cyber attack on its computers, followed by the classic "who us?" shrug of digital deniability. That would serve as a more concrete deterrent than empty rhetoric about missiles. Now we have just a few minutes to go before the program ends today. A couple of short notes. Sexual harassment complaints by French women have soared 600% since the arrest of former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn in May. The telephone never stops ringing. It's as if invisible barrier has been broken, said Olivia Catton, head of women's group Paroles des Femmes. About 70% of student finalists in the Intel Science Talent Search were children of immigrants, though only 12% of the U.S. population is foreign-born. Most of these finalists have parents from India and China who entered the U.S. on work visas. Last year, for the first time ever, America's annual wine consumption surpassed that of France, but it took a U.S. population almost five times as large as France's in order to do so. Airlines hauled in $21.5 billion last year from charges on add-on fees such as checked baggage, food, and buying a little more legroom. That's a 38% jump in revenue from such fees in a single year. And after hacking into the Islamist jihadist magazine Inspire, British intelligence agents changed the directions for making a homemade bomb to a recipe for making cupcakes. And now let's conclude with our poll watch for this week from The Week magazine. 68% of Americans say it would make no difference in their voting choice if a presidential candidate were a Mormon. 25% say they would be less likely to vote for a Mormon. 62% say it wouldn't matter to them if a candidate were gay, while 33% say they'd be less likely to vote for a gay candidate. 33% say they wouldn't care if a candidate didn't believe in God, but 61% say that they would be less likely to support an atheist who was a candidate for president of the United States. And that was from a survey done by the Pew Research Center. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen next time. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time. We'll be right back.